You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The incarceration rate in the United States is the highest in the world by far, over 4.5 times that of China, and is often criticized, the United States, for that and for its prison systems, especially its reliance on solitary confinement. Last week, an article in the New York Times revealed that the practice is also being used in immigrant detention centers throughout the country, with about 300 immigrants held in solitary confinement on any given day. In response to the article, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano asked federal immigration to review its policies on the practice. Joining us now is the author of the Times article, Ian Urbina. Mr. Urbina covers domestic and foreign policy for the Times. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, or not that well. I have a bit of a cold. What are the laws that regulate whether someone can be held in solitary confinement in the United States?
Honestly, I don't know the answer to that broadly. I do know specifically in immigrant detention facilities, the law is very dodgy, in the sense that there are guidelines, because these are largely outsourced facilities. So ICE has 250 facilities it uses to essentially detain 34,000 immigrants on any given day, and the majority of those facilities are actually just local jails and private facilities. And so while ICE has some rules on how these immigrants are supposed to be detained, and those rules have actually gotten better in more recent years and more protective of the immigrants, the ability of ICE to ensure that these local level facilities are complying with those rules is very limited, because it's such a broad reaching system. And that's one reason that you're seeing a lot of solitary being used, even when ICE itself, in at the headquarter level, is not a big fan of that fact.
And are reasons given for putting these people into solitary, as opposed to all of the others? You said 34,000 and 300 in solitary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so why the on average 300 immigrants were in solitary was not indicated in the data. But we did reporting and talked with ICE consultants and also ICE officials who had helped review the data, and were told that roughly two-thirds of those instances of those 300 were for disciplinary reasons, and that can range from anything talking back to a guard or getting in a fight with another detainee, or being caught with contraband in your cell. So those are the majority of the cases. The minority of the cases are administrative detention, and those are scenarios that are harder calls in many ways, in that they're aimed at being protective of the detainee or jail personnel. But more often of the administrative scenario is usually either the immigrant detainee has mental health problems, and the resident warden decides that if you put that person in with the general population, there's a good risk that they will be harmed, or the immigrant detainee is transgender or gay, or the immigrant detainee has, for some reason, maybe it's gang affiliation or maybe it's a cultural issue, there's some reason that there's a good chance that violence will occur. For those folks, they too have been put in solitary. And obviously the immigrant advocacy community is very bothered by that practice, because on the one hand, it's good to protect the detainees, but on the other hand, they argue there should be some option other than solitary confinement for protecting these people.
Now, are these people being detained because they're in the country illegally or because they've committed crimes?
It's a good question. So they are, and to get to the distinction you lay out there, these are civil detainees, and so they are being held on civil violations, and that's an important point. They have not been charged with a crime per se, and so they do not qualify for certain rights that criminal detainees do qualify, such as the right to a lawyer if you can't afford one. These folks in the data that we looked at were all folks who had, even if they had been, all of these detainees are being detained on suspicion that they are in the country illegally. Some of them have legitimate asylum claims, and therefore ultimately it's determined that they are appropriately in the United States, or they have been mistakenly picked up on the assumption that they are illegal, and they are not, but they didn't have their documentation to prove that. And many, I would say most, are actually in the country illegally. That is what they are being detained to determine. They're waiting for a hearing to suss out their actual status before the law. If they have committed a crime, let's say someone is picked up by the police on a DWI, on a drunk driving charge, and in the course of that intervention by the police for a crime, it's also determined that the person may be undocumented and therefore should be detained by ICE. These individuals in the data have already served their criminal charge time, and they've been then handed over to ICE to wait for their administrative hearing. So all the people, all the 300 cited, are people who, if they've committed a crime, they've already served their time for that crime, and now they're just waiting administratively for their status to be decided.
For how long?
How long are they in solitary?
Yes.
Well, so the data...
Because there have been studies that indicate that solitary confinement can have serious psychological trauma, can cause serious psychological trauma, haven't there?
Yeah, so the nearly half of the, on average, 300 people who the data indicates on a given day are in solitary are there for 15 days or more. And most of the research and the UN have designated 15 days as sort of the cutoff line beyond which the psychiatric harm done by being put in solitary can be most severe and lasting and possibly irreversible. Nearly half of the people are in there for longer than that threshold. And that's one of the reasons that the UN was especially concerned about this data. And then there's a smaller set of the 300, namely, roughly 35 detainees were in solitary for 75 days or longer. And that's an especially striking number.
The trauma experts have suggested that the impact of this kind of confinement may be even more acute for some immigrants. Why is that?
Well, oftentimes the ordeal of coming into the country illegally is a pretty traumatic ordeal. So it involves using the assistance of a trafficker or a coyote. In many of these stories, these immigrants have been essentially kept captive by their trafficker in safe houses, sometimes stripped of their money, sometimes stripped of their clothes, usually stripped of, any paperwork that would show where they were from, and kept there sometimes on the expectation of a ransom being paid by the family that is going to receive that immigrant. And so very often, this is a deeply traumatic experience coming in. Rape is not uncommon. And so that's one reason that this demographic is potentially even more vulnerable to the ill effects of solitary than anyone else walking along the street.
Which sometimes means suicide, doesn't it?
Right. So suicide is the best data on what happens if this mental harm comes from solitary is suicide. So in the federal prison context, for normal inmates, non-immigrant inmates, the numbers are, you know, roughly half of all suicides are from folks being put in solitary confinement. And we tried to get numbers. So the question begged then is, well, so how many of the immigrants in ICE's facilities being kept in solitary have tried or succeeded in committing suicide? And unfortunately, we couldn't get the answer to that question.
Now, the facilities are often private prisons?
That's right, yeah. A fair amount of, and I don't know the exact proportion, but of the 250, holding facilities around the country, a fair amount of them are private.
In a piece in yesterday's Times, you note that some immigration opponents argue that harsh detention conditions encourage immigrants to more quickly sign papers agreeing to leave rather than adjudicate the matter. Can we assume that's the government's rationale for this approach?
You know, now I'm speculating, which is an uncomfortable place to be, but my speculation would be no. I don't think that ICE, especially in the current administration, which has shown real signs of attempting to improve the processing of immigrants and the conditions at these facilities and the level of oversight of these facilities, I don't believe that the rationale is the one you refer to. I think it's more complicated than that, and I think it boils down to when you are handling 34,000 people, there are bound to be problems within those ranks, and there are bound to be conflicts, even violent conflicts. And so as the administrator of this population, you have to figure out how you can try to quell that. And it seems from this data that they haven't found the best way to both protect their own staff as well as immigrants, as well as the detainees themselves, while also not putting some subsection of those detainees in conditions that some, including the UN, have said may be torture. So clearly they have a ways to go. But I think their intention is to try to mitigate violence within the detainee population.
Juan Mendez is the United States Special Rapporteur on Torture, and he said that we should ban isolation for juveniles and those with mental disabilities. How many of the people being put into isolation are juveniles?
It's a good question. It's not one we were able to answer. We didn't have that level of detail, and we tried to report it out beyond the data, and we're not able to find cases where juveniles, later released, reported having been put in detention in solitary.
You've talked about how difficult it is to get data on all of this. Is that because these things are being treated as top secret? This whole incident is being treated as kind of a top secret thing?
No, I mean, look, I don't think that. And Ms. Napolitano said as much. She was not a big fan of the story. It's not a story that I imagine Department of Homeland Security or ICE is thrilled seeing in the paper. On the other hand, again, to their credit, advocates, I think, would concur on this. Slowly, the agency, ICE, has been more forthcoming with data and answers about the conditions that they oversee. It took an open records request, a FOIA request, to get the data, and it took quite some time for it to be handed over. I don't think it was sort of deemed top secret, and there was an intentional effort to prevent us from getting it.
My guest is Ian Urbina, whose article, Immigrants Held in Solitary Cells, Often for Weeks, was in the New York Times last week. I think it was last Monday, wasn't it? And then yesterday we have a follow-up article called Immigrant Detainees and the Right to Counsel. We'll talk a bit about that as well as we continue this conversation right after a little break. We are back with Ian Urbina. We're talking about immigrants being held in solitary cells, often for weeks, as he's reported in the New York Times. Harper's Magazine reports that the Obama administration spent $18 billion overall on immigrant enforcement last year. That's nearly $5.5 billion more than it spent on all law enforcement of the same time period. So this is costing the taxpayers a lot of money, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's a wildly expensive effort, and I think it's one of the reasons why there's sort of bipartisan, you know, support behind trying to figure out comprehensive immigration reform, just because it's draining the coffers.
Are the immigrants that are being detained largely from one part of the world? Should we assume that most of them are coming from south of the border, or are they from other parts of the world as well?
You know, I've never looked at the actual numbers coming across, you know, into the country. I've always assumed, and I think it's correct, that the overwhelming majority are indeed coming from Latin America.
You discussed several cases of detained immigrants in your article. What happened to Ronald Rojas Castro?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we focused in on three detainees in particular, and attempted to highlight them because they touched on different categories of different scenarios. So in Castro's case, let me start with Bin Rashid, if I can.
Okay.
So he was a detainee who came into the country. He's a Yemeni. He's from Yemen, but he had said that on his immigration papers that he was actually from Somalia. He was caught, so he was a textbook case of an illegal entry. And he was requesting, according to him, now the agency disputes this, but he had requested to not go to the cafeteria during Ramadan. And I guess there were words exchanged, and he ultimately was put in solitary for that reason. There was a second individual by the last name of Quiroz, who was a different category. This is a person from Mexico who was detained after being caught driving drunk. And Mr. Quiroz is gay, and in the paperwork relating to his case, it was clear that ICE officials were nervous about his well-being because he was, they believed, going to be targeted for violence or worse. And so they put him in protective administrative solitary confinement.
Can't they just put a bunch of people who they're concerned about into the same area of these prisons, whether they're improvised or whether they're federal prisons? Did they have to put them into solitary?
Yeah, I mean, so now I'm back on speculative ground, but I'll go there nonetheless. So number one, we just mentioned how wildly expensive the system is. The simple answer to your question is yes, in theory, but the more complicated answer is, in practice, that would cost more money. And also, right now, there isn't the infrastructure at many of these facilities. There's just not the space. And furthermore, you throw someone together of if you separate someone who's gay from someone who wanted to not go to the cafeteria for reasons of Ramadan, there's no telling that the violence you were worried about relating to the gay man may still be visited upon him by the other person who's in the, you know, kind of who's been pulled out of the general population. So now we're talking about isolating, you know, clusters. And that gets even more complicated and costly. So I think the one category where there has been significant progress in terms of implementing policies to automatically pull these folks out are mental health cases. Previously, in prior years, those who were deemed to have clear mental health issues were automatically sent, in practice, not guidelines saying as much, but to solitary. And now there's explicit policy forbidding that. And those folks have to be tracked. But honestly, I'm not sure where they're sending them, if not solitary and not general population. Just to finish, Rojas Castro was a textbook case of one of these people who came across the border. He was then held, captive for 5 days by smugglers with about 100 other people in a house, in a sort of safe house in Texas. He was then... someone found or got there. One of the immigrants in this safe house found a cell phone and called for help. ICE ended up showing up, rounded up the people who were there, and somehow, either in trying to escape or for some other reason, Mr. Rojas Castro broke his ankle. And so when he was put in the detention facility, he was on crutches. And again, according to Mr. Rojas Castro and his lawyers, he was told that he would have to go to solitary, because if he was left in the general population with crutches, the crutches could be used as a weapon. And that was the reason that he was put there.
But he's one of those people who you pointed out earlier had already been incarcerated in a different way and had already been traumatized. So there was no sensitivity applied here.
That's right. And he was kept, again, according to him, in complete darkness for 4 days, in only his underwear. So the story sounds like there was something more than just the crutches at issue there. The ICE says that contests this case and the details Mr. Rojas Castro gave. They contested it after. We had asked them for comment on all these cases before we ran the story, and they had not been able to give us, or said they were not able to give us, much detail because of privacy concerns. But when the story broke, something changed, and they suddenly gave us a lot more detail in rebuttal to some of these anecdotes. And in the case of Rojas Castro, they said that he was only kept for 2 days, and that putting people in darkness is not forbidden, is not allowed. And they also point out, and I think this is a fair point, that in his case, for example, he was kept for back in 2005, and much has changed since then. And I think that's true.
I'm speaking with Ian Urbina of the New York Times. He's written two articles about immigrants being held in solitary cells. That was last Monday. Yesterday, Immigrant Detainees and the Right to Counsel. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopez. So let's talk about that right to counsel. Is there any way for immigrants to take legal action if they've been treated wrongfully or unfairly?
Yeah, and there actually are some cases in the pipeline. One in particular to watch is a case that's been brought by the ACLU, where, in essence, they are arguing that, someone's detention was actually partially the result of a lack of counsel. And had they been afforded the right that criminal detainees are afforded and guaranteed, namely the right to counsel, even if you can't afford it, that this person would never have been detained. And at root here is a debate about whether, it's a complicated issue, because on the one hand, there are many immigrant advocates who argue that they do not want to see the undocumented immigrants being treated as criminals. So they're worried about the consequences of turning this into a criminal rather than a civil matter, and that in many ways that could be a step backwards. But on the other hand, as a civil matter, there are certain guarantees, such as the right to counsel, that are not afforded these folks. And as, you know, in the last 10 years, the way that we, the number of immigrants we detain and how we detain them has radically changed. It's grown in number, and as more information comes out, these type of detentions look more and more like a traditional prison, you know, traditional incarceration. And so the question, the constitutional question begged is, if you're treating someone in virtually the same way that a incarcerated criminal is treated, why then, in other words, they can be put in, they're vulnerable to prison rape, they are vulnerable to being put in solitary for extended periods of time, you know, then, and other ways, then why shouldn't these folks be guaranteed before the Constitution the same rights to counsel? And that's the case that they're pushing now.
Are detained immigrants given the opportunity to contact their families or people in their home countries?
It varies. Yeah, the official answer is yes. And I think in most of the cases, that is true. The reality is variable depending on where the immigrant is detained. So the rules clearly state that they must be given the right to make others aware that they have been detained, so they don't just disappear off the map. But the systematic access to the outside world, be it medical attention, be it lawyers, be it family, when you interview and immigrants who have left detention and you talk to lawyers who talk with a lot of such immigrants, you hear a fair number of stories about much more limited access to, outside contact than the rules supposedly require. And sometimes you also hear, when there are tensions between personnel, staff, and detainees, you hear some stories, and maybe, you know, personnel have good reason to be frustrated with the immigrants because they have broken rules. But for whatever reason, sometimes you hear stories about the use of phone privileges as a carrot or stick by jail personnel. So if you keep mouthing off, you'll get your phone privileges, but they'll be at 6 a.m. when your lawyer's not likely to be, you know, in the office. Things like this, you hear these stories where the right is given, but in a way that's not practical.
Have other countries criticized the way we've been treating our immigrants?
Yeah, so the UN took a look at this, and last month in March, a report came out on a number of topics, but there was in it a section that discussed the use of solitary, and quite especially in these civil detention contexts. And it pretty the report pretty firmly conveyed two thoughts. One was a real dissatisfaction with what sorts of answers federal authorities had given to the UN, or really the lack thereof, in response to questions about the use of solitary. And the other was, based on what paltry information was given, this is probably a violation of international law, and especially beyond the 15-day mark, constitutes torture.
So has that strained relations with any countries?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. My gut is, the UN and the U.S. have, a tense relationship to begin with. So I'm not sure that this is, if I had to guess, I don't imagine that Hillary Clinton, you know, has changed her, or I guess no longer Hillary Clinton. I don't imagine the Secretary of State, you know, Mr. Kerry has, you know, sort of changed his stance on this. I doubt this is a big blip on their radar.
Well, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, as we mentioned earlier, asked that the Immigration and Customs Enforcement review its policies pertaining to solitary confinement. Do we know when that review will be presented?
So my sense in talking with Homeland Security and ICE officials is that she was not requesting any sort of formal report, and they seemed very emphatic to convey that point. They were not, you know, calling for a whole-scale investigation of this. They were simply wanting more detail about these individual cases. So I don't imagine we should hold our breath for any white paper to come out on this topic. In the speech Ms. Napolitano gave, she said that she was sort of going to take a look at their policies in general. But there was no real clear indication that much more was planned.
So what happens to these immigrants in the end? Aren't most of them deported?
Another good question. And again, I wish I knew what proportion are deported. I do believe the overwhelming majority are. But on that point, one thing that is interesting and was brought up in the piece about the right to counsel is that the success rate of these cases is significantly, and this makes intuitive sense, significantly higher when you have the help of a lawyer. You know, the legal system is a Byzantine thing in and of itself. Put that on steroids, and now you're in the immigration detention system. So navigating that for anyone, not to mention someone who maybe doesn't speak English, as a new arrival to this country, maybe has prior trauma at work, combine all those factors and figuring out how to argue your case that you have, say, a legitimate reason to be granted asylum, that you legitimately will face harsh treatment if you are returned to your home country, that you maybe even are a legal resident here in the U.S., but there's a reason that you don't have documentation to prove that. Arguing these things in the system that is our immigration detention network is very tough, and so the success rate's very low in those cases, but it goes up significantly. I don't have the number right in front of me, but when there are lawyers involved. And what's funny about that statistic is used by both sides, both those who support the notion of the right to counsel for these civil detainees. They say this is just proof that people who should be allowed to stay are getting sent back, and that's simply not fair. Those who are opposed to granting immigrants the right to counsel use the same statistic to point out that if you give them all lawyers, there's a very good chance that a lot more of them will stay, and that's going to drive up costs and glut the system even more, they argue.
Although the number of undocumented immigrants living in the United States has declined by 900,000 since 2007.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so much of this is perception, the perception that, you know, the tidal wave of inflow is getting bigger doesn't necessarily correspond with historical data.
Ian, thank you so much for talking with us today. Ian Urbina's articles on immigrants being held detained without counsel and often being put into solitary cells have appeared over the last week in the New York Times.